So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, is Kay Burley leaving Sky? Will she be joining Team GB News? We speculate wildly. Also on the programme, as BBC Four stops commissioning new shows, what's left of the channel and its mission? Plus, Spotify buys the next Clubhouse. We look at the press outlets claiming furlough, what it says about the state of the industry, and we give you every sub-editor's nightmare in the form of our media quiz. It's all to come on this edition of the Media Podcast. And joining me today, via the magic of etc., it is planning director at Edelman, Karen Robinson. Hello, Karen.
Hello, Ollie.
It's April Fool's Day on the day we're recording, so the media are hard at work actively creating fake news. Has anything caught your eye?
Well, I have to confess to having been taken in by one, at least for a little while. It's been many years since I've actually been fooled by an April Fool's prank. But today, in my local neighbourhood of Walthamstow, I read a local media report that a Waitrose was coming to Walthamstow and got briefly excited.
Oh, I can imagine how excited that must have made you.
I was briefly very excited until I got until about paragraph four, when they started mocking the citizens of Waitrose for our supposed affinity for quinoa. And I thought, this isn't real, is it?
That's not nice. You get the slap in the face and you realize you're the target for satire. Yeah,
yes.
All at the same time.
They nailed me.
Also joining us, former broadcasting exec and all-round media guru, Professor Liz Howell. Hello, Liz.
Hi.
What do you think of April Fool's Day as a tradition? Does it still have a place? Because it does kind of erode trust, doesn't it, in news sources?
Yeah, it's horrible. I really dislike it. But on the other hand, it's a long-term tradition and it's very British in its way, I suppose. I don't know if other countries do it. I'm sure they do. But
well,
I think
Americans love it.
Yeah, that's true, but probably from a British origin. I don't know. The Germans have a similar thing, don't they?
Well, they like to put out press releases for Volkswagen that they then
I was just
going to
say, Volkswagen. But I do remember the very famous, I don't know if Ian and Karen would remember it, but there was one that The Guardian did years ago about an island called Sans Serif, and they did a whole a sort of extra supplement about this island and what you could do on this island and what it grew and and of course those in the know knew that Sans Serif was a font and it was a sort of printer's journos type in joke. But I remember people were really taken in by it. And I also remember when I was a kid on Panorama, they did a thing about spaghetti being grown in Italy.
That's one of the classics, isn't it?
I can absolutely, I can remember my mother turning to my father and said, "It doesn't grow there, does it, Fred?" And, you know, they were, well, my mother was particularly taken in by it. But it also makes you realise quite how it was much easier then when people weren't quite so knowledgeable as they are now. And they could be taken in, conned a lot more by the April Fool. Sometimes I think you're so worried about the April Fool that you become sort of grumpy and truculent all day.
I should say the Ian you made reference to that is also with us is LBC broadcaster, author Ian Dale. Hello, Ian.
Hello.
This isn't an April Fool's, we think. news just breaking as we record that Kay Burley may not be returning to Sky News, which uncannily was your prediction on the Media Podcast Prediction Special this year.
Yeah, wasn't it just? I got one right anyway. It does seem look as if it's true. I've just checked her Twitter feed and all mentions of Sky News have been eradicated from it. So it's been reported by The Express and The Mirror and is about to start trending on Twitter, I suspect. I don't think this is a great surprise. I think it would have been quite difficult for her to go back to that job. The question is, what will she do next? Of course, she started on Sky News with Andrew Neil back in 1989. So people will naturally draw the conclusion that she will go to GB News. They've already appointed two female presenters for their breakfast show, Kirsty Gallagher and Rosie Wright. It's not impossible that she could go there.
But she never really wanted to do breakfast at Sky, did she? She was kind of put on breakfast because, you know, they needed to do something with their breakfast show because it never really quite recovered after Eamon Holmes left.
Well, that is true. But given that they've filled up most of the rest of their schedule, I'm not sure where else she would fit. But does she fit their sort of presenter type anyway? I'm not sure that she's particularly right-wing, shall we say.
Liz Howell, you're raising your hand. Is it to say that you can have a breakfast show with more than two women?
Yeah, and you can have more than the number of women that they've already got on GB TV. They're going to have to think about it anyway because I did a sort of count up, and from what I could see, they've got 14 named presenters, and five of them are women. So their women are lagging behind, and they don't seem to be the bigger names or in the bigger slots. So a big name like Kay Burley would be a real coup for them, I would have thought. And we mustn't say, you know, oh, it's breakfast, therefore it's got to be women, on the grounds that women get up and make you breakfast. I don't know what that thinking is. I mean, Kay is a very competent journalist and could go anywhere in the schedule and do extremely well, I would think. And they can always, with something like that, squeeze, you know. There's weekends to cover. There's all sorts of things going on in the schedule.
Do you think, Karen, that if all the presenters that do provoke a reaction, that do have very strong flavours, are migrating away to GB News and possibly this new Murdoch effort, that actually Sky News might be looking not to replace them with equally spiky people, that actually the niche for Sky News might be to look even more like the BBC than they do?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you that Sky's strategy, I mean, the news is a lost leader for Sky, so they really use it as a reputational enhancer, right? So they use it to drive trust and affiliation from amongst their some of their stakeholder audiences, more so than to drive a commercial audience or a consumer audience. So as much as they obviously, you know, at Sky, they always want their ratings to be maximized, for them, it's about credibility and it's about reputation. And they've done a great job with the news service of building out that credibility and reputation. So I suspect they will be looking for presenters that have a lot of gravitas rather than, as you say, spikier ones in the next round. We'll see.
Okay, let's get on with some other stuff, but well done, Ian, for correctly predicting that back in late December. We're going to start with the BBC. There's nothing quite to compete with the seismic flood of announcements that we poured over in our last edition, but the Beeb have quietly this week let it be known that BBC Four will no longer produce new shows and will become an archive for the broadcaster. Sort of sounds to me a bit like, Liz, they're essentially evolving from the TV version of Radio 4 to the TV version of Radio 4 Extra. Do you think people will notice the difference?
Yeah, I think they will notice the difference. And one of the things that I'm interested in investigating, which I can't see anywhere, is if they're going to still be taking material from European and Scandinavian channels, which is something I really liked about BBC Four. You could get some really interesting drama there, and that's what I went there for. I think the idea of an archive channel is interesting and could be quite sensible. And if they're going to, for example, another of the stories is they're going to bring back BBC Three, so it's not going to be necessarily all bad news. Things have got to change, and BBC Four, if they're building up BBC Two, has always had this confusion with BBC Two. So I don't think it's necessarily awful bean counters ruining a fabulous national treasure. I think it could be quite a sensible evolution.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the question politically, Ian, because there's always a political dimension to these decisions these days, is whether a channel of repeats is a good use of the licence fee or the digital spectrum, and whether that's something they can justify. I mean, it might be. They might be able to say, yes, this is the best way to get value for money.
Well, lots of people think that BBC One and BBC Two have become channels for repeats as well. So I'm not sure this is a particularly innovative move. I actually don't think it's a bad one. I think it would have been a shame to have just got rid of BBC Four, as I know you were speculating on one of the recent editions of this podcast. I think that they have such a vast archive. If they can make it have a popular appeal. I don't mean just repeating things like Only Fools and Horses and things like that, but they have so many dramas, they have so many documentaries that don't see the light of day for years and years. And I think they really could make the most of this. And it could actually get a much bigger audience than it gets now. I don't know how often we all watch BBC Four, but I would say it's kind of once in a blue moon. And it's almost, I've always thought BBC Four was BBC Two light in a way, or heavy in some ways. What did I see the other week? They had a thing about Welsh poetry, and I was thinking, is that really something for a sort of mass TV channel? I'm not sure it is.
Well, this is it. So Karen, both Liz and Ian have made the point that you can see a lot of similar stuff on BBC Two. This might bolster BBC Two. I don't know if you saw what Armando Iannucci was tweeting about with regard to The Thick of It, but he was saying, well, that launched on BBC Four. If that hadn't happened, there'd be no Veep because, you know, The Thick of It wouldn't have led to In the Loop, which wouldn't have led to Veep. I mean, is that actually true? I'd have commissioned Armando Iannucci to make a new political comedy for BBC Two, wouldn't you?
Well, I mean, now that he's Armando Iannucci, yes. But before he was the person we know as Armando Iannucci, maybe not. I think you need
he
to give creators...
He was the person we knew as Armando Iannucci 10 years ago.
But you need to give creators a place to get started and do slightly riskier things and slightly things that appeal to a slightly different audience. So I don't know that it's going to be, you know, the end of the world as we know it for Channel 4 to switch to that. But I do think it's BBC 4 to switch to that. But I do think it's a bit of a shame in that the suspicion is that it's going to mean, you know, the net number of new programs produced is going to be fewer, which means each new program produced is going to be that little bit riskier and therefore, you know, perhaps a little bit safer. I think BBC Four was a place where you could be a little bit more experimental, and I think that's a good thing.
But proportionally, the amount of new material on BBC Four was relatively small, wasn't it? And I think a lot of people did associate it with buying in exciting and interesting external international product, and I'd like to know what's going to happen to that as much as about the production itself, because production will find a place. There will be an area somewhere where they'll try out the new productions and give them an airing. Whether or not BBC Four was the right sort of incubation for production, I don't know. Anyway, it's a big leap to get onto BBC Four even, so perhaps there'll be other areas for that. But I would like some reassurance that all these great Scandi noirs aren't going to go away.
They're not. I should clarify on that. So yeah, they've said there will be new Storyville still on BBC Four, and there will be international shows still on BBC
Great.
Four.
Well, in that case, I'm relatively happy.
Well, I guess, I mean, the stuff I used to watch is the kind of slightly nerdy kind of Neil Brand, Mark Kermode stuff. But that's so BBC, you know, this idea that we'll do an hour-long programme about how George Gershwin structured chords, that you kind of think, well, that will end up on iPlayer anyway. They're not going to not make that stuff because no one else makes that stuff.
What they've lost on BBC Four is right at the beginning, they used to do lots of political documentaries, which I absolutely loved, things that may not have ever been done on BBC Two. They haven't been doing those for several years. BBC Two have stopped doing them. I mean, Michael Cockrell used to obviously do these hour-long, marvellous documentaries. Nobody's doing those now. And now that the BBC politics department has been abolished and it's all been subsumed into news, news don't really make programmes. They make news programmes, but they don't really understand documentaries. And I really worry that on the BBC now, there is little outlet for proper documentaries I hope I'm not sounding too much like an old git, but those ones that we used to remember, that I'm sure, Liz, you were involved in commissioning a lot of them in the 80s and 90s. I think it's a really real shame that the public service broadcast of this country is no longer doing that kind of thing or not doing it seriously enough.
Okay, let's move on to audio now. And Spotify have found yet more money down the sofa. This time they've gone and bought a live audio social media thingy known as Locker Room. It is part of a deal that includes parent company Betty Labs. Karen, what do these words mean that I'm saying?
well, I'm still working it out myself, but Locker Room fundamentally is what they call a social audio platform currently focused around sport. So I think the presumption is that at some point, sport's a really good opportunity for live audio because obviously you can build a community around it really easily. But I think the intention is that they would take that technology, probably rebrand it for something a bit broader than just sport, and launch it out there. Probably, I would envision it being sort of like a Clubhouse competitor or something similar. So it's exciting. I think we're seeing a lot of proliferation of these platforms. I think a lot of them will fail. But I think Spotify have been pretty aggressive in trying to position itself to completely dominate the audio marketplace. So this is yet another example of that. And I wouldn't bet against their strategy. They're pretty dominant right now.
It's maybe in the nature of things, Liz, that people look at this kind of thing, and Clubhouse was the first to really make waves, and think, well, is this going to kill podcasts? Is this going to kill radio? As if there's sort of always a winner. But it seems like a completely new space, this idea of kind of live interactive audio.
It means,
as
it
I
means
say
very...
this, I'm looking at Ian Dell thinking, is it a phone-in? But I mean, it is kind of... It is kind of new in the sense that it's, you know, for the internet generation, I guess, and it can exist alongside, can't it?
Always new advances can be in parallel. You know, canals didn't die because of railways, and, you know, video didn't kill you, the radio star and all of that sort of thing. But I mean, I actually have a problem understanding what this Clubhouse thing is. So perhaps you could explain that to me before I can even begin to opine. I mean, having read through acres of material, and I still don't know, what do I do with it? Where do I get it? Do I have to be doing sports at the same time or something or other? What is it?
Yes, you have to be skipping at the same time. That is important.
I'm out.
Liz and I are so much on the same page on this, because I keep getting invites to Clubhouse and I'm thinking, I don't really know what it is. I probably will join it just to see what it is at some point. But there's only so many hours in the day to do social media-y type things. And I spend half my life on Twitter. I'm not particularly interested in getting another social media platform. But then again, if I do sign on to it, I'll probably become addicted and love it. But when I saw this locker room thing, first of all, I thought it was a Donald Trump podcast. I think, look, all new things are welcome. Some, as Karen said, some will fail, some will succeed. And those that succeed generally deserve to. And Spotify, I don't really use Spotify very much, but they are able to spot winners, aren't they? And they're very, very good at that.
Yeah, I feel like I should just say, for Liz and Ian's benefit, so Clubhouse, as the one who uses Clubhouse,
is it a popular music beat combo?
Yes, totally that. It's basically, if you think of it as a chat room, if you think of like a text-based chat room, but it's that, but audio. And I use it for a couple different purposes. We have, there's a regular drop-in discussion for fellow American expats that happens on a weekly basis that I've participated in. It sort of creates this little sense of community. But I think one interesting case study is I'm also a regular guest on a podcast where the podcast is recorded via Clubhouse. And the only difference to that is that the audience members can be invited in. So if you want to do a Q&A, if you're a podcaster, you can do it via Clubhouse. There's some facility to get audience members in to ask questions. So, I mean, I think it has its limitations, but it also has its opportunities.
But as the presenter, you still have the control, do you, to invite those listeners in? People can't just start talking over you and then they're on the show.
You can still shut them down, and you can choose who's there. But I mean, it's a pretty open platform.
I mean, I was saying, Ian, that it could be a competitive phone-in slightly facetiously, but actually, presumably that is kind of why Spotify are interested in this space. You know, they're obviously looking for radio style links in your daily drive and those sorts of playlists of pre-recorded podcasts. And this, especially around sport, I mean, they brought a sport startup. You can imagine, can't you, that it would be a threat to Talk Sport, for example, if they had a live phone-in about the rugby or the football that was happening on Spotify using this technology.
I think the key is getting the audience in the first place. And we all know when you start something up, whatever it is, no matter how much money you've got behind you, it's not automatic that you get an audience for anything. I mean, you look at, shall we say, some radio startups over the last few years who found it incredibly difficult, even when they've got a big name behind them, to get this mass audience that their star presenters will actually want to have. So I think in the sports area, There are lots of niches within sport that maybe are more difficult to find in other areas. And there's a massive market for sports podcasts now. I mean, I listen to 4 or 5 football podcasts, and I've only discovered 3 of them over the past 3 months, and they are literally new startups. But it's generally word of mouth that makes them popular. Now, can you have enough words of mouth to make this sort of thing popular? I'm not sure.
You're a West Ham fan, aren't you?
I am, indeed.
Go on. I've never asked this question in my life, but what is the best West Ham podcast? Give them a...
The best West Ham podcast is called More, M-O-O-R-E, i.e. Bobby, for your information, Ollie. more than just a podcast. And it's for fans. I appear on this podcast occasionally, but they record it on a Monday night, which obviously conflicts with the day job, so I don't do it very often now. They basically spend 2 to 3 hours talking about the week's West Ham related news. And I listen to it sort of while I'm driving home, and it's just like listening to four mates down the pub chat.
Yeah, typical that you'd choose a show that you're on. That's why we have you on this.
But thinking of this in terms of business, it reminds me a little bit of the rush to buy Friends Reunited. Do you remember when everybody got terribly excited about something that seemed to be going to work? And then in the end, it really came to very little, I think, for those who did pursue it. And there is this chasing after something that's often quite dangerous and can really be very a bad strategy for the original purchaser. So I don't know. I mean, Karen is probably in a better place to say whether or not she thinks this will work.
Well, I suppose finally on that, Karen, the reason Friends Reunited didn't really work for ITV by the time they worked out what to do with it was because Facebook had come along.
Absolutely. Actually, I was just going to say that.
in this case, Spotify, I suppose, is the Facebook of audio, isn't it? And Facebook are going to be playing catch up to do their own live audio thing. So maybe this is the moment that it does go mainstream.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is certainly Spotify's ambition to be the Facebook of audio. And I think they're taking a similarly, as I say, aggressive strategy to what Facebook did in buying up WhatsApp and Instagram. They're buying up other things. And I think Spotify is aware that there'll be winners and losers in each of the different areas they're making their bets in. And clearly their intention is to kind of put their money behind what they think is a good bet and then use their power to, you know, put that one in the winning position. Doesn't mean there isn't robust competition, though. There is. So it'll be really interesting to see what comes out on top.
Okay, whilst we're talking about podcasting, sort of, actually, let's discuss the new serial production that's about to drop. Karen, it's called The Improvement Association. Have you heard the trailer?
I haven't heard the trailer, but I know of the topic, which I'm super excited about.
Has anyone heard the trailer? I've heard the trailer. I can tell you it's quite dull, I thought. I mean, it's about election fraud, isn't it? Which should be quite exciting. And it seems to tap into a lot of the BLM chat as well, because there's a component about race in it. But I was listening to that kind of 2-minute trailer, not knowing the whole story, and just thinking, not sure I want a deep dive with this presenter on this subject, but maybe I'm wrong. Tell us what it is.
Oh dear. Well, the topic is fascinating. I mean, it's a story that I followed really closely from my, you know, my political bent. But in North Carolina, there was a House election, a U.S. House election that was very narrowly appeared to be won by the Republican candidate, until it turned out that the Republican candidate had been conspiring with a, you know, consultant to the campaign who had been running a vote balloting, a sort of voter registration outreach scheme, had been just taking the votes of the, you know, mostly African-American people he'd been working with and just ditching them effectively or filling them out fraudulently. So, and the thing that's fascinating about it is this is the kind of rumor that flies around, but it was just robustly proven. And there was lots of drama around it. It was this man's son, the candidate's son, who actually exposed the campaign. So it was a really fascinating, weird story and resulted in, I think, for one of the only times in U.S. history, a House election being just overturned, and they had to rerun the election because it was so clearly fraudulent. So it's a fascinating story. I would be surprised if the Serial team can't make anything good out of it, but sorry to hear that the presenter is dull.
Well, it's only my opinion. I'm just saying, I guess the expectation is so high. They're one of the blockbuster brands now, aren't they, in podcasting, that I expect to be completely blown away when I press play. And I just wasn't. Maybe there's more competition out there these days, or I don't know. It wasn't hitting the mark for me in the way that very first series of Serial, from the moment you press play, kind of sent shivers down your spine, you know?
Can I randomly pitch to you another podcast from a related team?
It's not about West Ham, is it?
It's not about West Ham. Check out Nice White Parents. Fascinating one from the New York Times team, and from the This American Life team and the Serial team, looking at a really interesting story around the New York school system and just, you know, endemic racism in it, but also kind of what happens where white parents show up and exert their influence on schools. It was really fascinating. I learned a lot from it that I didn't expect.
We will have more media news in brief after this.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Karen Lisney and are still with me to discuss some media news in brief. First up, some furlough news. News companies across the UK have continued needing financial support from the government. According to Press Gazette, that includes regional publishers JPI Media, Archant and Midland News, as well as The Guardian, who are the only national newspaper to use the furlough scheme. But Al Jazeera and Tortoise Media joined the scheme in January for the first time, it now emerges, and CityAM were the only publisher to reduce their furlough payments. Liz, what does all of that say about the health of journalism?
It's quite worrying in a way, isn't it? I mean, if people are being furloughed who should be journalists, who should be working on all the things we need to know at the moment, I think that's quite concerning. I think it's concerning that The Guardian's gone for the furlough scheme. I don't really know what their financial imperative would be there, why they would have to do that. And it just makes me feel very uncomfortable, to be honest. It just doesn't seem right. It's a bit like saying, you know, nurses are on furlough, isn't it?
Well, on that, Ian, The Guardian, I mean, they really pride themselves on having this unique business model and having the Scott Trust, you know, that they can invest in journalism. I mean, of all titles, there's a question mark about whether they should be using the furlough scheme at all, perhaps.
I mean, I don't know how much the Scott Trust have sort of squirreled away, but certainly I remember a few years ago it was rumoured to be around the £1 billion mark, so it does slightly stick in your craw when you hear that they are asking the taxpayer for funding. I think much smaller regional local newspaper publishers are in a bit of a fix, and I mean the story that the Press Gazette reported about Time Out. Now you can understand why Time Out would be in difficulty because they've got nothing to report on. So I don't think anybody's going to have a problem with them resorting to furlough money. But look, in the end, if people who read The Guardian don't like the fact that they've resorted to this, they will stop reading The Guardian. And the customer, in a sense, is king here. If you disapprove of something, you withdraw your customer.
Yeah, but then, Ian, The Guardian will want to put more people on furlough.
Oh, it's a vicious circle.
Because fewer people are reading The Guardian.
I mean, Karen, the Time Out example is interesting, isn't it? Because it has been especially hard for free sheets because their distribution model has gone. People aren't going to tube stations to pick up their free copies. And as Ian says, there's no one advertising events that aren't happening in them. And as a result, Time Out Media saw revenue plunge 58% in the second half of 2020. But could there be a bright side there if they just managed to cling on long enough? You know, people are talking about the post-pandemic roaring 20s. I mean, Time Out could be the place to find out about it, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously Time Out's an absolutely brilliant publication and I wish them well. I think it's noteworthy that one of the reasons why their figures look so particularly poor is that they'd had a very strong quarter immediately before, which suggests that their commercial model was working reasonably well. You know, they had switched, they were switching away from kind of relying on the print publication towards, you know, as you say, more free sheet distribution and being advertiser funded. Seems to have been working reasonably well. I think they were in a pretty healthy position. So all the more painful for them to have had to go through this. But as you say, it feels like a situational problem rather than a structural problem for them. So I have every hope that, you know, we would love to see them come roaring back. They're obviously add a lot of value to the London scene.
You know, the big challenge now, I think, for everybody, whether they're a publisher, any part of the media, is to think, okay, what is the second half of this year going to look like? And how can we maximize our commercial advantage from it? And there is going, well, I hope this is another prediction that I get right. I think the economy in the next 6 months is going to go gangbusters. Now, there are all sorts of dangers in that. For the government, they'll be worried about inflation. But I think for all sorts of commercial organisations, if they get their strategy right for the second half of 2021 and the first half of 2022, they could be incredibly successful.
And also, I suppose, Liz, the opportunity to take some of the learnings from the last year and a half about how you can have the agility to work from home, how it can be cheaper to use staff in a different way and actually make a product that might be more popular and generate more money that costs less to make.
Absolutely. I think often difficult situations like this do breed innovation and excitement. The other thing which I think people don't refer to very often is that for an awful lot of people, there have been huge savings during lockdown. A lot of people who, you know, I eat out an awful lot, so I've saved money on that, haven't been able to, you know, go on cruises. Not that I, well, would have been nice, but you know, that all of those holidays that you don't take, you've got that money. So there's a lot of people sitting on quite a lot of ready money to go out and have fun and enjoy. So I think there might be something in what Ian's saying, because if there's all this money there ready to be spent, people are going to want to spend it on things, and that will feed into a short-term huge boost for the economy. But on the other hand, it could be that everybody is terrified of dying and doesn't do anything but sit on their money. But I think the psychology is going to be more to spend.
Although ironically, I mean, I know Time Out is a massive global business now, and they run food halls and live events and ticketing and all these other things that have taken a huge financial hit. But actually, if you think of them as the original London magazine that's been running for 50 plus years, actually in the last year and a half, they'd have been better off, Karen, wouldn't they, sticking with a subscription model? I mean, that's the one sector of publishing that's been reliable, is people getting a magazine through their door and paying a premium for it.
Yeah, I mean, it might have given them a little bit of a buffer. I think it's interesting because I'm a classic example. I was a subscriber until they basically told me I couldn't be anymore, because I love the magazine. And had they been able to keep my custom, then perhaps mine and people like me, they would have had a little bit more of a blanket to cover them, to protect them through the hard times. So maybe that resiliency is something they'll have to be thinking about in the future, because this is surely not going to be the last global crisis that we will endure.
I also think the whole nature of subscriptions is very interesting, because I think an awful lot of people with all sorts of subscriptions, whether it's, you know, subscribing to be in a choir or subscribing to a magazine or whatever, have just kept on with them throughout all of this, because there's always that hope of normality. And there's also this feeling that you're supporting an organisation which you really value. So the subscription model is really core to keeping those finances going, but they'd already moved away from that. And I totally agree with Karen. If the small amount of subscription that would have been there probably wouldn't have gotten through this. This is a massive disaster for something that's marketing events, really, because there aren't any events.
It's interesting as well, that definition of subscription versus support. And we were talking in the last episode of this in a podcasting context about subscribe versus follow. But in media consumption terms now as well, I mean, that's what The Guardian are asking you to do, isn't it? Support their journalism. It's not subscribe to the product. There's this kind of Patreon world where the audience is prepped to give money for nothing in return, additional to what they can get from reading it for free.
And isn't it funny? We're criticising the BBC for not looking at the subscription model, and it may be that subscriptions are already out of date.
All right, let's talk about Eleanor Mills, the former Sunday Times executive editor who's resigned from the Society of Editors board. This is the continuing fallout from the Harry and Meghan interview, cross-reference episodes past. Liz, what do you think the Society of Editors needs to do to get on top of this narrative? It's kind of run away.
I think they need to modernise anyway the Society of Editors. I think, like a lot of things to do with broadsheet newspapers, they're very male-dominated. They're quite old-fashioned in their view. I sympathise totally with the stand that Eleanor's taken here. She gave them time. They didn't come back. And I think she did the right thing. It's not Piers Morgan here. You know, she was very temperate in the way she dealt with it. She went to them. She said she thought their response was inadequate. She waited for a response and it didn't come. So quite right too. And I think that the idea that somehow you can say, well, we're not racist, that's just too simplistic. You know, we won't go into who's racist and who isn't, but it's just too easy to say, well, we're okay. And it's not like that. So I'm 100% behind Eleanor on this.
She seems even to have been given the assurance that they were about to make a statement climbing down from what had happened before, essentially acknowledging that elements of the British media do have a problem with bigotry, and then never made that statement.
Well, it sounds to me as if somebody got at them in the meantime or whatever. But it's not like saying, well, we're bigots or there are bigots in this group. It's like saying, come on, we all need to check our privilege. I know that sounds very woke and whatever, but there are some things about woke which are really good, and that's one of them.
Yeah, but it doesn't sound like something the editor of the Daily Mail ever is going to come out and say.
Well, no, but that's why the Society of Editors exists, doesn't it? Because it can be an umbrella organisation and they can be under that umbrella without necessarily holding the umbrella, if you take the analogy. I think that the whole thing is just too pompous, and it comes from a very old-fashioned sort of standpoint. I don't know if Ian would agree. Perhaps he thinks I'm, you know, being a bit heavy.
I don't know
why
you would think that. I would think that.
Well, I don't know. I'm worried I'm being a bit unfair.
I agree with quite a lot of what you've said there. Look, Eleanor Mills, I mean, is a friend of mine, so that might have an influence on what I say. She used to commission me to write hugely long interviews, articles for the Sunday Times magazine. I was delivered about double the length of words I should have done. But I think that she has an absolute point here. If you, it doesn't matter whether it's a Society of Editors or whoever, in our society nowadays, if you haven't, as an organisation, looked to yourself in the mirror over the last year and thought, are we doing what we ought to be doing? Have we got a problem? And if we have, what are we going to do about it? I think most organisations have had those conversations internally. Certainly various organisations I'm involved with have. And it's absolutely right to do that. Now, the Society of Editors have sort of stamped their feet and said, no, we have got no problem whatsoever. And yet we, as the newspaper buying public or website viewing public, can see that some of them absolutely do. Now, I don't expect the editor of the Daily Mail to go on television and say, yes, we are a racist newspaper. I don't actually believe they're a racist newspaper, but they have had articles, they've written headlines that could lead people to believe that they are. Now, they are slightly, they will say, well, of course, we now know that a lot of the things that Meghan Markle said in that interview have been proved to be factually incorrect. So they can sort of lean on that as much as they like. But they still have a problem and they still have something to deal with and they need to deal with it.
Yeah, but Karen, what Eleanor Mills wanted was for them to come out and make another statement apologising for the statement they made before. And for, I mean, this is what you do, isn't it? Talk to brands about PR and stuff. I mean, from their point of view, would that not just sort of add a whole second act to this whole saga, which they're embarrassed by and they want to close down? Doesn't mean they're not having the conversation internally. They just might not want the whole world to be part of it again.
Okay, so if you're asking for my advice as a PR professional, I would point out that they're having the second act right now and they're not in control of it, right? So they've put Eleanor Mills in control of what the next version of the story is going to be. Whereas with a small amount, not even, it didn't have to be a mea culpa. It didn't have to be a rending of the clothes. It could have just been a simple look. Clearly, we've misstated our position. Obviously, you know, that there is work to be done. A little bit of humility goes a long way. And you don't have to say that you think the entire industry is rotten from top to bottom. You can just say, look, like all industries and like all people, we all have to work on overcoming our inherent biases. And that is something we take seriously. And by the way, we would like our minority staff members who work for our organizations to understand that we hear them and we take that seriously. It would have been easy to do and it would have solved a problem for them very quickly.
All right. One last newsroom news story, and that's that ITN have warned Ofcom that they risk creating a news desert within the next 2 years unless action is taken to give great prominence to high-quality news outlets. Ian, what do you make of what ITN have submitted to Ofcom?
Well, I don't really understand what they're asking for. What do they mean, give prominence to high-quality news outlets? We all know which outlets they are. What do they want, a little stamp in the corner of the screen or something?
Liz, you probably, I'm guessing, might have more sympathy with this. What they want is what they had before on Sky, which is prominence. They want that on YouTube and Facebook, don't they? That's what I interpreted it to mean.
But how can that happen? I mean, when I go into, say, Netflix, what am I going to see? Like an ITN button or whatever? I'm with Ian on this, although I'm very broadly sympathetic towards ITN. I think they're often overlooked in the way everyone stampedes to support the BBC. They're a great organisation and a great news provider. But I'm a bit vague about what they actually want as well. And I really did try in this one to be on their side, which is, you know, I might as well let my bias show. But I wasn't sure at all what it was that they were asking for, because it's not that there's going to be a news desert. It's going to be that there's a news smorgasbord of all sorts of crazy news outlets. That's the problem, if there's a problem at all. It's not that people aren't going to have news. It's going to have far too much news, far too much choice and be able to go down little niche. You know, we could have the whole conspiracy theory news channel or whatever. So there's lots and lots of difficulties about the proliferation of news, but a desert is not one of those difficulties. And what they want does baffle me too. But we must remember that they are an excellent news provider, and also that in terms of expense, that the money has already gone in to making the news the prime source of news. So actually reproducing the news on other channels is not a great expense. So I don't quite get the argument that it's too expensive for other organisations to carry that news. But you can't actually say to all providers of broadcast material, oh, you've got to have a news button and it's got to be ITN. I know that what they're trying to say, but it's not practical enough, that their response isn't practical enough, I don't think.
Is it that complicated? I mean, it's just, if you've got trending news on your service, they're saying the publicly funded stuff should be there. I mean, that's it, isn't it?
But how would that work? How would you see that? I'm not convinced. You already see it. It's all over the place. You know how to get Sky News. You know how to get ITN News. You know how to get BBC.
Karen's shaking her head, so you butt in, Karen.
Well, I think I'm not unsympathetic to the complications of it, but equally, I would say it has been a big problem in recent years that, as you rightly say, Liz, that it's difficult to ascertain which is the quality news outlets, which services we can trust. There has been, I mean, Edelman's trust data has shown that there's been a system wide reduction in trust across the piece, in media as well as in government, in pretty much everything. And so there's this loss of gatekeeper function has been a problem. And it is both technically possible, and I would argue probably in the best interest of the providers, to find a better way of signaling which sources of news can be taken as reliable with some justification and which are not. I think that Facebook has done a very poor job of trying to do that. Their efforts have been pretty pathetic so far. And I think it also is a problem in terms of, if you look at the television landscape, in terms of people's changing behaviors. I think if you look at streaming services, Netflix, etc. I mean, you can argue they have a lot of news on there, but actually not consumed in a news-like format. What they have is lots of documentaries and so forth. So they don't really have anything that we would consider to be a regular news update. So I think it's not unreasonable to say that we should think about this. Maybe ITN hasn't handed them a ready-made solution, but I think it's something that would be in the best interest of both the consumer and, I would argue, the regulators themselves to find a way to make that work better.
What would it look like? What would I see when I was going to get this public service broadcast news element when I'm doing my...
It would depend on the platform. But, you know, on Facebook, it could be as simple as giving more prominence to more trusted outlets, which is something that they've tried to do. They've just done a terrible job at it.
I mean, it could be as simple as when you're clicking on trending news, you are presented with five news stories, and one of them is always from, as Karen says, one of these PSBs.
Yeah. But this is a typical attempt of existing media companies trying to stop new entrants coming into the market, because they are scared that they will lose market share to these new entrants. You look at the barrage of criticism that has been aimed at GB News before it's even broadcast a single second of news output. Oh, it's the British Fox News. Well, Andrew Neil is absolutely adamant it is not the British Fox News. Well, we'll see when it comes on air. The BBC, ITN, and to an extent Sky, all have a vested interest in this, in keeping new entrants out of the market. They're not going to be successful, though.
But we're in an international world as well. And I just wonder whether all of us being a bit more media savvy than your average news consumer. I mean, if you're talking about someone who, let's say, is in their 20s and lives in Britain and is presented with a news story from RT and a news story from Deutsche Welle, and they're in Britain and they don't know which one of those is more trusted. They're both just foreign news outlets. Not every 20-year-old is able to navigate that in the same way that the people who run the likes of YouTube are.
It's very simple. Ofcom should withdraw the license from RT. It's as simple as that. Because it is not a trusted news service. We all know that. We know that it's funded by the Kremlin. We know that it's completely biased. And I don't understand why it still has its license.
Right, but when it's on Facebook, its license is less material, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's the point. I mean, because Ian, you're talking about new entrants to the market, and I'm not going to get into you a question about GB News, because as you say, we haven't seen it yet, so we don't know what it's going to look like. But a lot of the new entrants to the market on many of these platforms are not actually news providers at all. They're malicious proprietors of false news. under the guise of deliberately working very, very hard to make themselves look like credible outlets, and consumers are misinformed. And I think it's, you know, it is a problem. And I don't think we can just wish it away by saying, oh, well, the market will decide, because it hasn't and it won't. Many of the new entrants are just not credible sources of information.
I suppose the other point, though, Karen, is that to take my demographic example, it might not be that younger people don't know that the news at 10 is on ITV. It might just be they don't want to watch it.
And if they don't know where it is,
they're just not interested.
And if they don't want to watch it, that's absolutely fine with me. Right? But it should be prioritized over other outlets which are not doing journalism in any meaningful way.
If ITN want to reach your demographic, they could easily create a strategy to do so. I'm not aware that they actually have done. They don't have a 24-hour news channel. I don't remember seeing clip after clip going viral on Twitter from ITN, but I see that from Sky News. I see that from the BBC.
On Channel 4 News, you do see
Channel
a bit,
4 News,
you
do as well, but you could class that as opinionated news as well nowadays.
Well, yeah, that's okay. Let's park this argument and talk about cricket. That'd be nice, won't it? Because BBC Local Radio has secured the rights to county cricket in England and Wales for another 4 years. Do people realise how much coverage there is of cricket in local radio? And is it good news for cricket fans? Ian, you've told us that you listen to football podcasts. Are you a cricket man as well?
I do like cricket, but I could think of nothing worse than listening to local radio cricket commentary of a county cricket match. I'm thinking the audience must be in the dozens or the hundreds for that. And you could say, oh, that's public service broadcasting. But I mean, you only have a limited amount of hours to broadcast in a day. And the one thing that isn't in this story is how much the BBC have paid to have this privilege. And I think I could probably think of better ways of spending that money.
I suppose, Liz, it depends on the audience appreciation indexes, though, doesn't it? I mean, the audience who are listening love it.
In fairness, Ian, there'll be a lot of factors going on here with local appreciation and so on, and local sponsorship and all the rest of it. I mean, it's something which doesn't interest me terribly. It interests my partner a lot. He likes cricket and he likes county cricket and so on. It does seem a bit arcane. And as you say, there isn't the bandwidth to have infinite sort of arcane and odd sports on there. It depends whether or not you think cricket's an important way of life and therefore should be reflected by the BBC. I don't see an awful lot of harm in it, except if it takes time away from things I would like to listen to.
Well, it's mostly on long wave and medium wave, I think, when local stations are broadcasting it. So it's not as if they're depriving.
Exactly. Exactly. Is it a problem? It's sort of like, I don't really know why we're talking about it. Sorry, I don't want to be rude about this incredibly wonderful podcast, but it doesn't really rock my boat. Sorry, but I don't mind other people listening to it.
That might be the story. I mean, local radio have been able to get the rights to this because probably there aren't any national media players that are interested in it, Karen.
Well, there's probably no competition for it. But think about how many people you see going to a county cricket match. And that will tell you of the level of interest. I mean, this week also, the BBC, I think, have paid millions of pounds for the rights to cover women's football. Now, that may send a signal, it may send a message, but how many people are actually really interested in watching women's football to the extent they ever go to a match?
When I ran UK Living, we did a really nice line in women's football and we got really quite good figures for it. It was really quite popular.
Yeah, I think women's football actually does have a sizable audience. I wouldn't put it in the comparison with local cricket. In the US, the women's football team does much better commercially than the men's team. They have far more fans than any of our men's national teams. So, big up to the girls there.
Yeah, maybe you should give it a chance, Ian. All this West Ham stuff sounds like a bit too much to me. You know, why don't you diversify a bit?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to lay my cards on the table. Watching women's football is like watching it at 33 and a third RPM compared to the men's at 45. I don't think it's entertaining. I'm sorry. I'm not being sexist about it, though I know everybody's going to say I am. But I just don't get the same enjoyment out of watching, even if it's West Ham women playing. There's a documentary on BBC Three about them. That was actually quite interesting. But as a sport, it's just not the same.
Is it the case that in this fragmented media landscape, though, there are so many narrow and niche interests? I'm not saying women's football is necessarily one of those, but certainly, as you say, county cricket probably is. There are so many of those sorts of interests that they're best catered for by the silos of podcasting and, you know, channels on Discord or whatever, than they are on local radio these days. I mean, it is still public money being spent on it, isn't it?
Yeah, and look, there are so many different outlets now for everything. And as you say, I was listening to Laura Koonsberg's COVID Confidential podcast, the two-episode podcast, sort of doing a deep dive into what's happened. And it was quite, I mean, at times it was quite funny. You think, well, this would never get onto Radio 4 because of the format. It was very podcast. You think, well, it's great that podcasts exist for that. And they exist for, there are lots of non-league football podcasts and lots of really niche sports that none of us would be remotely interested in. But you don't always have to chase the biggest audience, I suppose.
Yeah, we're all glad that podcasts exist. Which brings us headlong into our final format point, the Media Podcast Quiz. This week, it is entitled Backwards Thinking. I will read you some media news headlines from this week in reverse order. You just have to tell me what the story is. It's best of three, and you buzz in with your name if you know the answer. So, Liz, you will say?
Liz.
Ian, you'll say?
Ian.
And Karen, you'll say?
Karen.
Here's story number one, but what's the story? BBC leaving after News GB to McCoy, Simon, join.
Simon, Karen. I think the story is Simon McCoy is leaving BBC News to go to GB News.
Yes, a good hire, Liz. What do you think?
Yeah, I do. I like Simon McCoy, and he's quite unusual. And you know, he does make these remarks sometimes, which we've all seen the outtakes. And I've known him for a long, long time. He's a very professional and, I would have thought, temperate sort of person, which I wouldn't have expected to find Simon on, you know, Britain's Fox TV. So there you go. That plays into Ian's point about we ain't seen nothing yet. But I do think he's a good hire. The only thing, as I say, about GB TV that bugs me slightly is I don't think we've got high profile enough women. So watch this space again.
Yeah, unless, of course, by the time this comes out, we all know that Kay Burley is doing The Breakfast Show. Here is question number two. Algorithms, anti-misinformation, Facebook by Hitmash Daily. What's the story? Buzzing with your name, you know the answer. Shall I say it again slower? Algorithms, anti-misinformation, Facebook by Hitmash Daily. And you literally just need to reverse the words and then you've got the story.
Ian. Daily Mash Ian. Hit by algorithm misinformation.
Close enough. Yes, the story is that the Daily Mash was excluded from Facebook's anti-misinformation algorithms, even though it is satire. Good. And I've lost track now of who's winning. But anyway, story number
I'm
three.
I'm winning.
Yeah, fine, that'll do. Review strategy media amid delayed briefings,
Ian.
Press televised, 10 number.
Ian.
Number.
Ian clearly was there in front, I'm afraid.
Number 10 press briefing room that was used for the first time by Boris Johnson this week. I think Allegra Stratton is going to start her daily or three times a week briefings on the 17th of May, 6 months later than planned. The whole thing's cost $2.6 million. It does look a bit Kremlin-esque, doesn't it, in the colour scheme. It's a bit gaudy.
Well, it also has a blue screen in it, Karen, which just seems like a basic fail, doesn't it, if they don't want to be Darren Duttoned all the way to the bank.
I can only assume that they did it on purpose because they have set themselves up perfectly to be memeified. Maybe they theorised that they'd rather generate a million negative memes and be heard than go silently into that good night. Who knows?
I mean, as our resident yank, do you think we need White House-style briefings?
I don't think the White House needs White House-style briefings. Actually, one of the big fascinating things to watch in the Biden administration has been how well we all get along in the media landscape without having daily White House press. I mean, the White House press briefings have been very effective, but Biden's only done one press conference, and it's kind of been fine. You know, I don't think we necessarily need to speak from the podium of the White House all the time. You know, put out the information from the subject matter experts.
Do we not all miss Donald Trump's press conferences? I mean, come on, whatever we think of him, it was box office TV, whereas Biden's, I mean, I'm sorry, it was a complete and utter snooze fest.
I think
a president or a prime minister in the modern day needs to do more than one press conference every couple of months. Although, having said that, I can't remember the last time Boris Johnson did one.
Well, exactly. We're going to get Allegra Stratton, who at the moment is, what, she's being paid $120,000 a year? I mean, that doesn't seem like good value for money right now. Yeah.
I think she'll earn every penny of that.
Can I just say something I think is quite intriguing? Because Karen talked about going gently into that good night, which is a quote from Dylan Thomas, who is a very famous Welsh poet, who was probably featured in that documentary on BBC Four, which Ian talked about. So we've come full circle.
There you are. Thank you for trying to raise the tone there. Whilst Ian goes full shock jock, let's bring back Donald Trump and cancel women's football. Nonetheless, he has won the quiz. Ian Dale, congratulations. Thank you to all our guests, Karen Robinson, Liz Howell and Ian Dale. We're all heading off to Clubhouse now to have the after show debrief, but we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with more of this sort of thing. Do follow us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts so that you never miss our briefings. I've been Ollie Mann, the producers Matt Hill and Peter Price. The Media Podcast is a Rethink Audio and PPM production. Until next time, bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.